Apologize for getting starting a little late. Wasn't sure we'd even get started at all, given that we're living in Washington as opposed to Chicago, where I'm from. I remember only two times in my life where we shut everything down. You had to exceed 24 inches in Chicago to stop doing business. So thankfully, we were able to do this today. Congressman Wu is going to join us in just a few minutes. So let me describe what we're going to do. I'm Rob Atkinson, the president of ITIF. I want to welcome you all. We will start with a presentation by Dr. Erica Fuchs, and then depending on the Congressman's schedule, he'll make a few remarks as well. And then Tom Arison, and then I'll just make a few wrap-up remarks. We'll have plenty of time for questions, and we will adjourn at 11 o'clock precisely. So let me start by introducing Erica Fuchs. Many of you know Erica or know of her work. She's an assistant professor in the Engineering and Public Policy Department at Carnegie Mellon University. And her research focuses on the role of government in technology development and the effects of location on competitiveness of new technologies. Before coming to CMU, she completed her PhD in engineering systems at MIT and was a Sloan Fellow at the MIT Industrial Performance Center. And she won her dissertation, won the best doctoral presentation in 2005. And she won the best technology and policy master's thesis in 2003. And in the fifth grade, she... this is too hard to keep up with. She also was a fellow at the United Nations in Beijing, and her work has been published in journals such as High Temperature Materials and Processes, Computer Composite Science and Technology, Journal of Lightwave Technology, Issues in Science and Technology. So Erica is actually one of those people who we really want to have involved in this debate because she is an actual engineer, unlike me, who pretends to know something. Erica is actually an engineer, but also does this nice Venn diagram overlap with technology policy. So it's really a unique set of skills. And so, next to Erica is Tom Arison, and Tom is the senior staff officer in the Policy and Global Affairs Division of the National Academies. He joined the National Academies in 1990 and has directed a range of studies on international science and technology relations, innovation, IT, higher ed, and strengthening the U.S. research enterprise. And most relevant for today's discussion, he was the lead project director on a recent National Academy of Engineering study called The Offshoring of Engineering. And welcome, Congressman Wu.
Robert.
And we're joined now by Congressman David Wu, who, again, probably doesn't need an introduction, but I will do one. Congressman Wu is a Democrat from Oregon. He's in his sixth term now. He is serves on the Education and Labor Committee, and he is also chair of the Science and Technology Subcommittee on Technology and Innovation, in the Science Committee. He is has a bachelor's degree from Stanford, attended Harvard Medical School, and received a law degree from Yale in 1982. And I think his paper in the sixth grade was the award-winning paper.
on salmon.
That was it. Salmon migration in the Pacific Northwest. He has a distinguished legal career, including a clerkship with a federal judge in Portland. And in 1988, he co-founded the law firm Cohen & Wu, and for a decade worked with high-tech industry and numerous small businesses across Northwest Oregon. And lastly, he is also a member of the New Democrat Coalition. And in all of those capacities, he is a real leader for technology and innovation. So we'll start with Erica, and then go to Congressman. So, Erica, we're right up against the screen here.
So before I get started, I did want to briefly give thanks to Julia Lane. I don't know if she's here at the moment. But the part of my work was funded by the NSF Science of Science and Science of Innovation Policy, and they also, I was just thanking you, Julia. and they've been critical to starting out my career, actually.
Hey, Erica, do you mind using the mic?
Because no,
it picks it up when we tape it.
Excellent. The gentleman there, I think you may not, because we have the projector there.
Oh.
May I go?
Yes.
So Paul Krugman and his Nobel Prize winner in his 1995 book, Development, Geography, and Economic Theory, criticized economics for occurring in a wonderland of no spatial dimensions. I personally believe that the same is true, and I hope I'll convince you with my slides today, that the same is true for our management of technology, our national innovation policies regarding technology, and even our engineers, that they don't understand the importance of location. Now, what my results are going to show you is that when you move manufacturing overseas, the overseas production economics switch the most competitive technologies. And for a matter of fact, they reinforce the economic viability of the old technologies and reduce incentives for pushing forward innovation. Okay. So, I may need to move away from this. We'll see if I can do it from here. Today, only 28% of manufacturing added occurs within the United States, and that number is continuing to decline as the percent in industrializing nations, like in Southeast Asia, grows. Now, traditionally, our literature has told us that firms are going to first produce in what's sort of the north, the industrialized nations, close to the locus of innovation, and then only over time move to developing nations. This was a theory by Vernon in the 1960s, and throughout the 80s, we saw broad empirical support for that idea. But today, we no longer see that being supported. For a matter of fact, more and more firms are being what we call born global. So from their very instantiation, they are located with some portion of their productive activities overseas. So as a consequence, today's firms who are offshore vary in their size, their age, their technology, and the very reasons that they are offshore. Now, the literature that has emerged trying to understand this offshoring of productive activity primarily has been focused on firms moving to meet demand in international markets. So we're moving to China in order to understand what the Chinese market might be demanding. And yet only 15% of firms are actually driven by market access in their moves overseas, according to a recent study. Whereas at the same time, 91% of firms report moving overseas in order to reduce costs. So if we think about this movement overseas, free trade literature would suggest to us that this is going to, we're going to benefit from the gains from trade. This would be traditional economic arguments, and that's going to lead to greater global efficiency, and then we start to debate over who wins and who loses due to that greater efficiency. For example, Samuelson had been saying that, in 2004, free trade might not always advantage the U.S. economy. For a matter of fact, now, as labor overseas is cheaper than that in the U.S., real wages in the United States may fall. And then his student says, no, the gains are going to be more than enough to compensate the losers. In the short term, developing countries' skills aren't going to be able to compete with the skills that we have in the United States. And by the time their skills improve, the U.S. is going to be further ahead. Right, and that's Bhagwati arguing back, and then people start arguing back and forth about, well, how many engineering grads do we have in the United States versus in India, and does everyone really win? So if we look back to the arguments of the 1980s, we found that there was net job growth, not disappearance. We don't know how that will pan out today, and actually what one of the biggest problems was who lost their jobs. So it was that the middle wage and low-end manufacturing jobs is what was being lost. But in all of these arguments, the underlying theme is that the key for the United States to stay ahead is innovation. That basically, we're going to be farther and farther. We're going to keep innovating. That's Bhagwati's argument. And therefore, we're going to be willing to pay more for our workers. And for a matter of fact, that innovation leads to economic growth. So as an engineer, when I started looking at this problem, the question I said, well, wait a second, if I think about what I learned in engineering
and all the variables that come into how you choose technologies and choose designs, should manufacturing offshore change the relative competitiveness of technologies, and thereby the technology trajectory of the firm and the industry itself? And so I said, okay, well, manufacturing location is going to change all these manufacturing characteristics, not just wages. It changes yields, it changes downtime, changes material quality. And according to the models I learned in school, that should change the most economic design and thereby the technology trajectory of the industry. And for those 15% of firms who are moving overseas for market reasons, well, that should only just add to this difference, the difference in where you locate and what's going to be the most competitive technology. So I looked at two cases, and I tend to work from the bottom up, so I'm in manufacturing facilities collecting data. The first was, but both of these cases are emerging technologies that had not yet been invested in fully. They were in their early stages of implementation. The one was the big three through Freedom Car had come to work with me on fiber-reinforced composite unibodies for automobile bodies for vehicle lightweighting and energy savings. And then the other was that the computing and telecom industry had come to me to ask whether integrated optoelectronic components, and I'm going to talk about that in detail in a moment, were economically viable or not for the telecom firms themselves. So in both cases, these emerging technologies were at the moment that they were being studied perfect substitutes for each other on the market. So right then, people weren't willing to pay more for that energy savings lightweight vehicle body. People weren't willing to pay more for the added performance that was given by integrated optoelectronic components, but people believed that there were properties about these technologies that were associated with demand preferences in the long term. So for example, in the case of the composite unibody, as energy savings became more and more important over time, these technologies may gain a competitive advantage. And we'll talk about optoelectronics more in a moment. So in both of my cases, my firms were moving manufacturing overseas during my study, which gave me a chance to get data in the United States as well as over in China. In the automobile industry, they were moving overseas for market proximity. They wanted to be close to the Chinese market. And in the optoelectronics case, they were moving overseas to reduce costs. So I'm going to give you one brief insight into my methods, which again are going to be very different than an economist as an engineer. So what I do is I build large-scale CAD and production models. So I can link, if you look over here to the product description, I can take a product description in a CAD model, I can play with that product description, see what that means for my operations research facility from a manufacturing facility at high volumes. So that means as I change the geometry of my car door, how is that going to change the cycle times? And thereby, how is that going to change the number of pieces of equipment on the line? And thereby, once we start changing how we have to operate this manufacturing facility itself, how does that in turn change what the unit cost would be? And these models are used, I work closely with industry, in order to determine how they should be making technology investments prior to putting out those large-scale investments. So what I do is, as I'm collecting data, I'm out there in the firms, working with engineers, working with production managers, getting details on their designs, the old and the new designs, details on their production process, the existing production process, as well as additional requirements, as well as differences then in each location for not only wages, but yields, downtimes, material quality, and so forth. In addition, I go through and I do interviews with most of the people in the firm, all the way from the shop floor up through executive level decision makers. So I thought it's always good to give you the bottom line early, and then you'll see if you want to stay for the rest of the talk. So if you look across both of my technologies, emerging technologies, what I find is that manufacturing offshore in developing East Asia shifts the relative economic position of the emerging design and the prevailing design. In particular, the emerging design is more cost competitive in the United States, but the old technology, the prevailing design, is more cost competitive in developing East Asia. And what I find in both of my industries is that the firms follow those economics. They produce the prevailing design offshore. And while, I mean, you can't argue with this, right? This is economically rational for these firms to do. They're saving money in the short term, But then there's the question of, well, what about those long-term markets? What about energy savings in vehicles if that becomes key in the market in 5 years, or even now? What about the long-term market consequences in optoelectronics? So let me tell you a little bit about this optoelectronics space. I'm going to go through these two slides quickly, but this is just to give you an idea of the level of data that goes into this. So I worked with about 23 firms. 10 of them were manufacturers that held together 65% of market share. I was working with all five of the US leaders holding largest market share. The remaining two leaders globally were in Japan. And then also the other key players technologically who were trying to fight for space in this industry, like Intel and certain startups. I spent time on manufacturing facilities in both cases, and I would often present at the industry consortiums, and I did over 100 interviews just in this industry alone. The other is, if you can imagine the production process, so there's over 150 steps to produce an optoelectronic transmitter, and that means that in my model, I'm able to mimic the production of 54 different production processes, and those all have inputs. I'm not going to go into those details, but an engineer could go into this model and change around the different production processes and produce a different design if they wanted to. What's powerful about this particular technology is it really gives you the feasible production region for emerging technology. We validate that internally with the firm, so I make sure that if I take one of their products, I put it into my model, I get the same manufacturing facility they do for the same model. And we also tend to help them out in exchange for their data. So, here's the case. I was looking at this thing called integration in optoelectronic transmitters. This is the idea that you can produce multiple functions on a single chip. So if we think about electronics, you have, everyone knows about Moore's Law, we're putting more and more transistors on a single chip. This is instead using light instead of electrons to send and receive information. And here we're putting more and more different functions on a single chip. And that's hard. This is not a mainstream industry. So originally, this innovation in integration was driven by the telecom market. So firms producing for the telecom market wanted to improve network performance, reduce size, and reduce costs. So if you look over here on the left-hand side, I've got my old technology. This is a discrete transmitter. So here's a laser that sends light. The modulator turns it into ones and zeros, and you find these throughout fiber optic cables underneath the ocean. You find these in fiber to the home. These are major players that are considered the canary in the coal mine for the telecom industry. In contrast, in the integrated design, all that happens is that laser and modulator ends up fabricated using semiconductors techniques on a single chip. Now, this was being pushed along by telecom, this ability to fabricate more and more chip functions on a single chip. But in the long term, the computing industry, and part of the reason that they were funding this research, was because they needed this technology to continue pushing forward Moore's Law. So they had identified in the ITRS roadmap that by 2012, they thought they needed computer optical buses that would be between core and memory to communicate, as well as possibly core to core. So if you think of your new multi-core microprocessor, and they needed to be able to integrate 7 functions on a single chip. So if you look at it, the next step already in telecom, they were working on integrating the isolator onto this chip. And as you integrate more and more functions on a chip, this transmitter becomes smaller and smaller, and finally is able to fit on a computer chip itself. The problem was is that in 2000, the telecom bubble burst, and by 2003, revenues in the telecom industry were 20% of what it was forecast. And so the industry driver went from these firms pushing forward the latest in integration, where Intel had already formed some alliances and some of the other computing industries to be able to hopefully buy up this technology in the long term, to suddenly all this industry was worried about was surviving, so working on efficiency and cost. So, at the time, this is when I started going into these firms, they had this huge pressure to drive down costs, and the engineers in the firms were saying, look, guys, just give us a moment. We've got this great new technology, it's called integration, and we're gonna drive down costs. And the finance guys in the firms, who suddenly had a lot more say in what was going on, were saying, you know, engineers, that's really nice, you've got some nice new technologies, but I've got a way to get rid of those same material package and labor costs. I'm going to move overseas, and it's going to happen a lot faster than you guys sitting here on the lab floor or the shop floor. And so 7 of the 8 firms that I was studying at this point moved manufacturing overseas. So the first question that you might ask is, is, you know, did these engineers have any idea what they were talking about? Was it really cheaper to produce the integrated design? And so this is a picture of, in the United States, so here's unit cost on the y-axis, here's annual production volume on the x-axis, and so here this red line is the old discrete technology, this green line is the new emerging technology, and so you can see that as a firm, that's average in the industry. If your core competencies were not so good in the new technology, you might have been better off producing the old technology. So here, if I only am able to get yields in my new technology of 2%, then I might be better off producing my old technology. But on the other hand, in these bands are the range that I was seeing across the industry and firms in terms of yield capabilities. If, on the other hand, I'm a firm producing the old technology, and I'm the best in the industry at producing the old technology, guys who are average at producing the new technology are going to basically, in the long term, beat my socks off. They have cheaper costs. But the problem is this is just looking at a U.S. production economic structure, right? So the next question you might want to ask is, did the finance guys have any idea what they were talking about? And for a matter of fact, they did. So here is that same red old technology produced in the United States. I've gotten rid of the bands, so this plot doesn't look a little too confusing. Here's that new technology produced in the United States. Here's that old technology produced just about anywhere in developing East Asia. So you've got at the top here, this $4.51, that's wages in Singapore. At the bottom, you've got 57 cents, that's wages in Shenzhen in China. It doesn't make that much of a difference, as long as you're down here and not up at $12 an hour, as well as now this has all of the other factors and differences in terms of materials, yield, downtimes across the two production processes included. So the first question that you might ask me is, okay, well, this is very nice. Well, I'm going to toss one thing in here before I go forward, which is a lot of people talk about footloose manufacturing. The next thing that's going to happen is we're going to move from Shenzhen to Western China, and after that we're moving to Vietnam. But this difference in wage between Shenzhen and Singapore makes very little difference compared to other differences that we're seeing across regions. So here is how much you can reduce your material costs by moving overseas, local mom and pop shops helping out. Here's how much you can reduce your overall costs due to improvements in yields. So these women on the line, and it is all women, gluing together the chips, were able to do it better than they were back in the United States. And also they were able to throw more engineers more cheaply at the line and get out that last 25% of yield problems in the back end assembly. So that's what's really driving where you're going to locate in developing East Asia. But the first question people often ask me is, okay, this is very nice, Erica, but where is the new technology in developing East Asia? Where's that line? And the fact is that this was a huge problem. They could not get US engineers from California to move their families over to developing East Asia. This is a much greater problem than you would think. There was actually a leader of global operations who explained to me, he called it career suicide, where the guys would go over, it sounded great to move your family to Singapore, was a great adventure, and within a few weeks or a few months, he would have to pull them aside and say, look, you know, you really need to go back. Your wife's unhappy, your kids are unhappy, no one wants to be here, and even in these top cases, they just couldn't get people to move at all. As far as leading engineers. So they didn't have the skills in developing East Asia to produce the new technology. And you don't see those skills, and I can talk about that more, developing right now going forward. So there are no patents in this new technology in developing East Asia at this point in time. And also I've watched two graduates from universities move overseas, one to the University of Hong Kong and the other to the National University of Taiwan, and they're just starting out their lives as a brand new PhD student, so they don't have enough people there yet to produce these new technologies. And the problem is these engineers, you can't get them off the production line. So even as I was interviewing them, every 15 minutes, they'd be getting a call from the shop floor where someone's saying to them, hey, you know, we can't get our product out the door, it's not working. And so we would suit up in our bunny suits, we'd go down to the production floor, and he'd be like, you know, it's Mary. I think when she's on the line, something's different about how we're running temperature. Or they play with the oven. It's not a standardized industry yet. For a matter of fact, it's about where electronic semiconductors was 30 years ago, and very common similar yields across the two. So the other question you might ask me is, okay, well this sounds Great, okay, we can't do the new technology overseas, but what about we keep a plant with the new technology back in the United States and a plant with the old technology overseas? Then we can kind of invest in learning about the new technology for the long-term computing market, and we'll do the other one overseas to bring down our costs in the short term. And the problem is that the market size in telecom is approximately equal to the minimum efficient plant size for these firms. So if you look back here, actually, I'll just do it this way. Here, basically, where we start reaching economies of scale, prices for these transmitters are about the same as where they reach economies of scales, and so is the global market size. It's only in the hundreds of thousands. So they can't afford to have multiple manufacturing facilities. They need to be at economies of scale, and they can afford one manufacturing facility globally. And that was the decisions these firms were facing. So the last question you might ask is, okay, this is all good, but how about producing the new technology better? We're going to ramp up the learning curve in the United States. Well, for a matter of fact, how this works is that 43% improvements in yield would be necessary for the new technology produced in the United States to beat out the old technology produced offshore. And actually, in my paper, you can see these dynamics just increase over time. So as local mom and pop shops emerge overseas, this becomes more and more difficult to achieve. Basically, the developing East Asia line just comes down farther and further. So this is not, 43% improvements in yield is not an easy thing to do. So to summarize, we've got this huge pressure to drive down costs. The engineers are saying, let's push forward with the new technology. We're going to reduce costs. The finance guys are saying, we don't have time to wait for your new technology. We've got to move overseas and reduce our costs now. So in this case, I've got small short-term markets in telecom that are demanding these lower costs. But by 2012, Intel thinks, and there's billions of units a year in computing, that it needs the same technology for a matter of fact, more of this technology, the ability to integrate 7 functions in order to keep pushing forward Moore's Law. And so if you think about this, Moore's Law had led to 50% of growth in GDP in the 1990s, according to Jorgensen. This is no small impact on our economy. And there's many problems with multiple cores beyond communications between ships. So offshore manufacturing definitely reduces the cost competitiveness of the new technology. It reduces the viability of producing that new technology. So the question becomes, by moving production, are these firms reducing their incentives and even their ability to stay ahead? So what happens in my firms? 7 of the 8 firms move offshore. They're producing the old technology offshore. 1 stays in the United States, actually, and produces the new technology in the United States. And so if I look across these firms, what's different about that one that stayed in the United States, who's venture-backed, he hadn't gone public yet. And so he was working under a different set of incentives than these public firms that were selling at large scale. So 2 more firms also show up in the United States producing the new technology and focused now on the computing market. And those guys, again, are not yet selling at large scale. They're actually funded by SBIR funding, as well as by DARPA and the DoD. So these are firms that are not independent yet and having to survive on market dynamics. So, okay, what about Moore's Law? Are we changing the path just of the firms that moved overseas, of the industry altogether? Are these guys over here going to survive? So Intel's already been pushing back 2012. They're not making 2012, according to the IRS roadmap in terms of bringing optical electronics on chip. So, or have we just changed the locus of innovation? So maybe the individuals who were laid off or left these firms have just gone to a new startup. Maybe they are keeping pushing forward and we've held on to that technology. And that's some of the work I'm actually looking at now, is trying to figure out what happened to these individuals who were doing the R&D. So to summarize, moving manufacturing overseas reverses the economics of the new versus old technology. The old technology, whereas it's more expensive in the United States, becomes cheaper than the new technology overseas, and the firms follow those economics. And while that makes sense in the short term, this may be overlooking long-term consequences for innovation. So I do want to finish off with talking about how I see my 2 cases as being different. So to me, there is no question, looking at these 2 industries and in general at the dynamics of production economics overseas, that manufacturing location matters for design competitiveness. it changes the vote, and firms don't get this. All of the firms I was working with didn't care where they were locating. For a matter of fact, they kept asking me, why are you spending all this time in China? And then when they saw the results, they thought, oh, this is important. But it's not something firms are taking into account in their decisions. So I think we need to teach our technology decision makers that location does matter for which technologies are developed and which technologies are economically viable. And then the question is, well, how should we think about, how should we be supporting firms to manufacture in the United States? And I think what we want to think about is how these cases are different. So the Optoelectronics case, these guys are very constrained. They can't separate manufacturing from R&D. They also have a small market, and they can only afford one manufacturing facility. So my question to you would be, is this typical of small high-tech firms? And if you look at the literature, this is particularly typical of small high-tech firms in process industries, so chemicals, semiconductors, pharmaceuticals in their early years. So what I would argue is that if you're in the case where you're really constrained, like the optoelectronics industry, manufacturing offshore is going to change your path of technology development, and you need to understand how that's going to affect our industries in the United States as a whole. But on the other hand, if you're like the automotive industry and you can afford multiple manufacturing facilities, then you could actually diversify your product development portfolio and leverage those differences in the different nations. So now I promise this is the last slide. Here, in the early part of the 20th century, R&D was in corporate laboratories. And so our new system now in the United States, we've shifted R&D to venture-funded small and medium-sized enterprises. And the whole idea in the 80s and 90s was that these small firms are considerably more flexible and innovative. They're not held back by large corporate structures. And so the large firms should source their innovation to these smaller firms through technology alliances and acquisitions. The problem is now, unlike in the past, these small firms can produce the old technology cheaper offshore and don't have the incentives to push forward the new technology, then where are our large firms in this system supposed to get their innovation?
Great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Erica. We're going to turn it over now to Congressman Wu will make a few remarks, and then we'll wrap up.
Well, the first time I saw Erica's presentation, I thought it was absolutely eye-opening. It's thorough work in one industry that may have very broad lessons for us, and it was a very much of an aha moment. And it is important because you all remember, I was in Silicon Valley trying to get a start in technology law. And you all remember, and I certainly remember this, some important person in the Reagan administration famously said, potato chips, silicon chips, doesn't matter as long as we make a margin, it doesn't matter. Can't remember who said that, but that's one of the most foolish things that I've ever heard, because, cash is cash, but that's hardly everything that we think about in public policy or in structuring a society. If you think about potato chips, you got an upstream, you got a potato farmer, maybe somebody who makes the equipment and somebody who supplies the oil to fry it in, and downstream you have a distributor and you have a supermarket or some kind of store on the corner to sell the chips, the potato chips. And if you think about the infrastructure that it takes to make a silicon chip, a microprocessor, it's very, very different. And it has very different implications for the complexity of the economy, for the number of other jobs generated, and it has, in that particular case, national security implications. If our supply of potato chips were cut off by a sole source manufacturer overseas, it would be very, very different than if our microprocessors were cut off, or in the Taiwan case when they had an earthquake and a lot of their quartzware was broken. Thank God we had a lot of stuff in inventory, because otherwise it could have really disrupted our economy. What you make does matter, and it has implications for the rest of the economy, and it has implications for national security and competitiveness and everything else. I think that that body of thoughts and Erica's work, which begins to demonstrate that at least for some industries and some technologies, where you make it also matters. That this is not a frictionless block sliding down a frictionless plane the way that you're taught early physics, you know, mechanics. This is how your shoelace stays tied. You know, friction matters. Now, when you think about classical economics and the way that we think about classical economics in this town, that body of knowledge is 200 or 300 years old. You know, I mean, elected officials think in Adam Smith terms. And there may have been a whole lot more work since then, but we're not really very familiar with it. And I had a different aha moment when I was walking around some of the labs at Oregon State University, and I took my son to a football game, but I was trying to teach him something along the way, so we're puttering around these labs. And it's an interesting university because there's a lot of engineering there, and there's a lot of research there. And it struck me that in the physical sciences, you have physics and you have engineering. In this field, we have economics and what? We don't even have a word for it. I mean, the closest we come is we can say economics and business, right? I mean, what is applied economics? Would you trust a physicist to design and build an airliner? Probably not. However, the same person who consults on Wall Street or gets a Nobel Prize at Harvard, does policy or applied economics here in Washington. Is that appropriate? Is that like putting a physicist in charge of designing the 787? Well, you know, you can wonder how the engineers did anyway on 787, but you know, that may be an object lesson. Not in the photo-optronics, is that what you call it?
Optoelectronics.
Optoelectronics. It's different from optronic, whatever. It's a different case, but again, how you structure the manufacturing chain for a very complex piece of machinery like the 787 has some implications for quality control, integration, and if Boeing had put all their facilities or their prime contractors, subcontractors in the United States, would the process have been different? Would the date of delivery have been different? Would the cost structure be different? I don't know. But somebody is trying to tell us that potato chips, silicon chips, doesn't matter. That manufacturing here and manufacturing there doesn't matter. And we begin to suspect that at least in certain discrete cases and in some very important cases, it does matter. So in essence, we have been studying frictionless blocks sliding down frictionless planes and guiding our policy accordingly. When we know that if the whole world did work that way, our shoelaces would not stay tied. So we need some more granularity in how we think about these problems. Because I don't think that we have been very well served by the elected official version of classical economics, in that we're still using 300-year-old ideas and competing in a 21st century world where not everybody is playing by the same rules. So we do need to adjust our intellectual framework. We need to start there, because in our form of government, an idea that has some traction gets implemented pretty quickly. And if you have the wrong idea and it takes dominance, you will be misguided for a very long time. We need to do more thinking in this field. I want to commend Professor Fuchs for her work in stimulating more discussion, but I want to particularly focus just one second on what Rob is doing at ITIF, because the task is not to reject everything that the classical economists have taught us. You know, there's some fundamental wisdom in what your grandma said about the way the world works. But you gotta supplement that with other things. And I think that what Rob has been doing here in Washington, D.C. for quite some time through ITIF is starting to get more granular about what it is that makes an economy productive, competitive, what is innovation, what spurs innovation, what are the blockages, and what are the ways to promote it, and what are the intellectual frameworks which may be well suited for it, and some which perhaps overlook the role of innovation, the role of placidness, the role of the choice of product. So it's a very, very important set of inquiries to begin to look at. The role of government in this is that there are two things. One is we seed idea development, technology development, and we should be seeding that, S-E-E-D. We should be seeding that in this study of innovation and a better development of whatever that space is that goes next to the word economics, you know, the applied thing that we don't have a word for yet. And also, there's the phenomenon of scale. When we do get things figured out, there is no other way to achieve scale the way that government can, whether we're talking about public libraries, public schools, or a publicly owned military. What government is good at, one of the things that government is good at is scale. And if this is an important phenomenon and has some processes that depend on scale, then government will have a very important role to play. Rob, thank you for including me in the program. And I apologize, it's a fascinating discussion, but I have two committees going on right now, and they are in my core areas. So I've got a scoot, and I'll look at I'll look at the cliff notes after.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those comments. And also, there's some seats here. Feel free to just come on up. You don't need to stand the rest of the time. Before I turn over to Tom Harrison, I want to mention the economist who said that, a famous line, was Michael Boskin, who is more on the physics side of the economics world than the applied side. And there's a really good reason, a good thing that potato chips don't have Moore's law, because if they did, we'd all be overweight and dying of heart attacks, because they'd be free. So with that, Tom, do you want to add your comments and thoughts? And
thanks a lot. Good morning. I will just take a few minutes here as the respondent. Echo Representative Wu on the commending Professor Fuchs on this important groundbreaking work. And also thank Rob Atkinson for inviting me, and commend ITIF on the range of programs and reports that you do on very important issues. And commend Representative Wu as he leaves on his long-term interest in issues of globalization of innovation and impact on the U.S. economy. So the hearings you held 2 years ago were very important on those issues. So. A couple minute or two about the project that I was the lead staff officer on, produced this report, Offshore and Engineering. For those of you who aren't familiar, the National Academy of Engineering is a private nonprofit. It shares the congressional mandate with the National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council, to provide advice to the government on science and technology issues. National Academy of Engineering Spotty Feminine Engineers, and it has its own program of activities on specific issues important to engineers, and this report was in that program. It was, the project was supported by NSF and the United Engineering Fund. It took the form of a committee which organized a workshop, commissioned papers, looking at offshoring of engineering in six industries, three of them related to IT, semiconductor, software, and PCs, and three other industries, autos, pharmaceuticals, and construction engineering. And so the commission papers from expert authors, we had the workshop, and then the committee wrote a summary with findings, not policy recommendations, but findings, and we put out the report in 2008. The committee was chaired by Bill Spencer, the former CEO of Semitech, and we had mostly a lot of National Academy of Engineering members on that committee, as well as a few economists. So what I'll do is raise three points where there's kind of a finding from our report that's related to some of the issues raised by Professor Fuchs's work, and then kind of a question coming out of that for policy. And the first one, what we found in the offshoring of engineering report, and just step back, is that this work discussed today was kind of looked at manufacturing as kind of a focus, and ours looked at manufacturing among other things. We took kind of a broad definition of engineering as, you know, things related to manufacturing, production engineering, but also R&D, design, and a wide range of things. And so we looked at things like, you know, the movement of jobs where when manufacturing moves, and also the connection between manufacturing design and how those jobs and activities might move together. But it was the work we just heard about was kind of more focused on manufacturing processes. But we found a lot of similar things. One is that there's a great diversity among industries in their motivations for offshoring, the kinds of activities that they offshore, and so forth. And you have cases where, you know, you have the emergence first in semiconductors and then in other things in the 80s and 90s of very disaggregated business models where, you know, the fabulous semiconductor companies, and now, you know, the emergence of where you have a design and you can offshore a lot of the engineering work to India. You can have the device manufactured in Taiwan or in mainland China, and in that way, and what we saw in some of those industries, the U.S.-based companies can stay ahead by being the first to identify market need and then be able to put together all the capabilities to address that market need without a lot of capital investment and very quickly. So you have that. You see in those sorts of industries where offshoring and the ability to access global capabilities is and manage that process is a competitive advantage for a lot of U.S.-based firms. Then you have cases where there's a great deal of market diversity. We heard about autos and the ability, you know, where there's a capability in a particular location that might be leveraged globally, and where companies might be offshoring some of their engineering, they're offshoring their production, because in autos, you know, one of the rules is to build where you sell. You know, and that kind of has held true historically in the auto industry. And increasingly, the design and R&D elements are also go to where the vehicles are sold. And so where you have a situation where General Motors, for example, would have its small car center of excellence in South Korea, because that's that market, you know, will drive innovation in designing and building small cars. and where companies outside the U.S., Nissan, Mercedes-Benz, and so forth, Daimler-Benz, will locate their large truck design and manufacturing in the United States because that's kind of a unique product niche that's driven by the market here. So you have those sorts of elements. And then you have cases where design will follow manufacturing. And if you see industry where fairly early on in the 90s, many of the main laptop companies don't do their manufacturing anymore. They kind of set the design standards. And then manufacturing is done by firms in Taiwan. Increasingly, the Taiwanese firms will do most of the design. And increasingly, manufacturing and design is moving to China through the investments of those firms based in Taiwan. So I guess looking at this great diversity of innovation models that we have, and where, if we start with the kind of idea that we had Bell Labs and they produced a lot of great things, and now maybe we should reproduce that. In some cases, that might be the model, but in other cases, there may be other things, such as work at universities, SBIRs, other sorts of programs to and policy interventions to maintain U.S. capability to innovate in these different fields. If the goal is to provide the best environment for innovation in the U.S., best environment to innovate and to capitalize on that innovation to create good jobs. And that brings the second thing, the importance of the macro environment. And Professor Fuchs mentioned the telecom bust, the boom and bust of the early 2000s is playing a big role in the decision making of these companies. And that, that we found that as well, where, if you're looking, what is the implication for jobs of offshoring? That's kind of a thing we get a lot. And what we found, and again, I'll get to data in a minute, but what we found is that the macroeconomy and the fortunes of the individual companies have a lot more to do in the short term with the loss and gain of jobs than kind of offshoring or globalization itself. And the globalization, the importance of that is as kind of a long-term factor in restructuring how and where innovation occurs. So that, and in that connection, Fred Bergston had a column this morning in the Post about exchange rate and the currency, and that is a major factor in whether manufacturing is cost effective in the U.S. or not. So the macro environment is very important. The last thing our report said, and a lot of reports say, is that we don't have enough data. We need to know more about particularly services offshoring and innovation in services, which is the largest part of the economy now, and how does innovation occur in services, and how does trade occur in services, and we don't collect that at the government level, don't collect that data very much or very well. We don't have as many categories. And so, and that we call for that in a lot of reports. One problem is that in the budget environment that we're in now, collecting more data may not be an activity that, people, the political environment will favor going forward. And that's why we may not have all the data we need, and that's why it's very important for things like the NSF support for this work and Sloan Industry Centers and so forth to do very detailed studies of industries and to follow those over time. So that is those are my remarks. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. All right, I'm going to. So,
I'm going to just take the liberty of making just a few suggestions and then close with some sort of overall political, small p political comments. You know, I think there's a bunch of things we can do. If we're really serious about this notion of what we want to do better in engineering-intensive production systems in the U.S., and recognizing that there's a lot of production systems in the U.S. that we're not going to do well in, and they're basically low-wage commodity assembly jobs, which isn't our competitive advantage, but engineering-based production really should be. Let me suggest four things we could do. One, we could expand the engineering directorate at NSF. They're on target, at least when I looked at the budget numbers yesterday, and they're on target to receive less money in 2011 FY than they were in 2009. Seems to me that that's going in the wrong direction. And it also, we could expand the ERC program. I would tweak it a little bit here and there, but generally it's a good program and is underfunded. Secondly, I think what Eric was talking about with the road mapping, I think was probably the focus center program in the MARFO program that the semiconductor industry has.
The international technologies, the semiconductor is road map.
Yeah. So there's a very good program that DARPA funds with the semiconductor industry. It's called the Focus Center Program. It used to be called MARCO, Microelectronics Advanced Research Corporation. This is a great program, but there's only one of them. Actually, there's two of them. There's another one that was around for a while in shipbuilding. There's no reason we couldn't expand this and do 20 of them. Let industry come forward, put up some of their own money, some of their own leadership, and then fund these research initiatives, in this case, at universities. Thirdly, I think we need to be thinking about making the R&D credit a more effective tool. In 1992, the R&D credit was the most generous in the world. In the US, we're 17th now. We just issued a report that's out there. If we expanded what's called the Alternative Simplified Credit, the ASC, from 14 to 20%, we would end up creating we would end up, according to our model, which I'm happy to share with anyone, 162,000 jobs. We create $90 billion in additional GDP. And in tax revenues, assuming there's a little bit 3 or 4 year lag in terms of getting that, tax revenues would be twice as much as expenditures, tax expenditures. So $17 billion in added revenues to the federal government. And the second thing is to allow process R&D. If you want to do a lot of that complicated work Erica was talking about, and a lot of that is process R&D, you cannot take that in the R&D credit. We only allow product R&D to be taken in the credit. I don't think that's sort of some view of the old world, the way the old world used to work at best. It certainly doesn't work today in the new world. And lastly, I would commend you to look at Fred Bergsman's piece today. Very nice piece in the Post, or the Times, I don't remember which, it was the Post. And I would argue that one of the things we need to do, sort of align along the lines of where Fred was, that we actually have to have a trade policy that's about market opening and market enforcement. We do very little enforcement. We let countries get away with a wide array of things, standards manipulation, certainly currency manipulation, all sorts of strange tariffs and taxes to manipulate their economies and to protect them from other competitors like the U.S. So let me actually, before I jump to that side, one quick thing. I think in a lot of ways the debate we've had in the last decade has been a largely counterproductive debate, and it has basically stalled out policy. The debate has been offshoring's good, offshoring's bad. It's sort of, light tastes great, and it's less filling. it just hasn't gotten us very far. And I don't think that's the right debate. The debate, sure, there's absolutely parts of offshoring which are good for the U.S. economy, good for the world economy, and good for everybody almost. And there are parts of it that are more problematic. And as Erica's work alluded to, I think we need a more nuanced discussion of that. And in particular, I'm more and more convinced that what we need, if we're going to drive a real innovation policy and strategy in this country, which, by the way, almost every other country has except us, we've got to find a way to bring both sides of these debates together in a unified part. So on the one, I can't really see that, sorry for that, but on the one hand, I would argue you have this sort of what I would call the globalist view of the world, and it's sort of not sure whether it wants to fight currency manipulation. It's a little waffling on that. It's a little waffling on should there really be a big role for government in public investment and innovation. Talks about it sometimes, and it certainly doesn't really talk about worker protections. You know, could we do a better job of trade adjustment assistance or retraining or things like that? So the globalists are sort of, you know, we want some things, but these are the other, these are some things we don't want. On the other hand, you have what I would call the nationalists, which are proposing things like Buy America provisions in various bills, unilateral tariff imposition outside the WTO process, limits on high-skill immigration, reduced trade liberalization, and increased corporate taxes, including ending deferral. Now, the problem is each side will argue that they're right and that this their strategy is the best strategy for the country. I don't know that we're going to resolve that debate, and in some way it's kind of irrelevant. What I would argue, though, is that there's this sweet spot in the middle that if both sides could come together on, we could make a lot of progress. And the sweet spot, essentially, to me, is three things. It's we can, I think there should be agreement on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the, not the aisle here, although that's true, too, both sides of this debate, that we need to do a much better job of trade enforcement. That this is a lot of this is about unfair trade practices that other countries are engaged in. Secondly, that we need both public investment and tax incentives. I mean, very interesting, we did an analysis of McCain-Obama tech initiatives in the campaign. They both committed about the same amount of money, about $70 billion a year. Senator McCain's proposals were 90% on the tax side, and Senator Obama's proposals were 85% on the spend side, or the invest side. And we need both. And it's I think the fact that we can't come to an agreement on this, and finally we do need to expand the help for workers. I think there's legitimate ways that both sides would agree. So I guess my hope would be that this year, as we reauthorize competes, and there are other things we could do, that we could really build a coalition that agrees to jettison a few of the things that people don't like and come together with this more hopefully common sense approach that would drive agenda. So we have 15, 20 minutes for comments, and please direct them to Eric if you'd like. If you can raise your hand, identify yourself, and your question.
Hey, Eric. I'm Debbie Manoftal. You know, if our R&D, according to your last slide, is being spent in small and medium-sized firms, did you have any thoughts on what kinds of public policies we could do to direct towards those firms?
Right. So I actually have a slide which,
I actually have a slide which has three policies that I would think of. The one is, I think, some form of SBIR funding, which would support holding over these firms until the other markets kick in. So in the case of the optoelectronics industry, there's applications not only in computing, but also in solar and biotech and military applications. And so these markets are uncertain. It's hard for a small firm to survive until those markets arrive, but they may be cost effective and probably would once those types of profits and revenues would kick in. So I think some amount of small business funding, and that's exactly what you see, is that the firms that did stay here and are targeting those long-term markets are funded by DARPA, DOD, SBIRs. The second, actually I concur very much with Rob, not on the small business side, but I think the dynamics in these models, you definitely see the same dynamic happening in Singapore, but China is a little bit more ahead, so the valuation of China's currency, I don't think changes these dynamics, but it might lessen them, might give US firms a bit more chance to have that new technology in the US compete. And that's a dynamic we want overall. And the third is, I think, education of our technology decision makers that this is going on, which people who I worked with, both in the automotive and the semiconductor photonic industries, just semiconductor industry altogether, these are the big computing firms, just had no idea that these dynamics would play out the way they did.
Edith Holloman from the Science Committee. Everybody's focused on jobs, but your model basically indicates that when the technology becomes accepted, the mass jobs will not be here. That all you get are these small numbers of jobs when the technology is developing. But when it's accepted, it goes overseas. So where do the jobs come from?
Yeah, so I'm going to be a little careful here. I am not personally clear on the link. So I would say the link between this work and jobs is far apart, right? So what I'm really focusing on this work is the incentives for technological innovation and how production location changes, basically, or reinforces the old technologies. So whether or not, I think in this particular model, the idea that if these firms stay in the United States in the and manufacture in the United States, the photonic semiconductor industry, I don't actually have an answer for would they eventually go overseas or would they eventually not go overseas. I think I couldn't tell you that. So whether or not there would only be jobs in the short term or also in the long term, and how much, you know, are those jobs the manufacturing jobs or are those jobs the R&D jobs? That's outside, I would say, the realm of this work. I think what's inside the realm of this work is that we do know that innovation and technological advancement leads to economic growth, and there, this would suggest that we're losing the incentives for what's supposed to be the United States' comparative advantage.
I mean, another way to think about that is if you think about Raymond Vernon's work that you're really, I mean, a lot of people who do this work build on Vernon's work, product cycle. And then actually John Reese's work, Product Cycle and the Decentralization of U.S. Manufacturing. And what that theoretical base is essentially saying is that high-cost regions will never stop the erosion of sort of commoditized production away from their region. And now the U.S. is the high-cost region. It used to be New England was the high-cost region. What high-cost regions need to do is continually move down on the product cycle and earlier stage of the product cycle and continue to innovate. You want to innovate and then slow that process down of erosion. And I think what is to me impressive about Erica's work is suggesting that this dynamic is, A, not letting us innovate, which should be our natural advantage, and B, the cost advantages, partly through the yuan and other kinds of manipulation, are speeding that process across. So I don't think it's right to somehow say that if we develop third-gen optoelectronics that we're going to have this for 100 years. That's not really the right question. The question is, are we going to have it for 10 or 20 years? And then as we develop fourth-gen, which who knows what that's going to be, we'll get those jobs. And then as on-chip integration becomes commoditized, then the Chinese get those jobs. I think it's a more of a dynamic process, but the problem is that the dynamics are not working in our favor the way they used to, and partly because of policy failures, I would argue. Why don't we go here, and then Nancy.
So related to that question,
my
name is Julia Lane. Related to that question is the emphasis on small firms. I would have thought that the emphasis is not on small, but on young firms. Right, there's a growing body of research of people who look at job creation, for example, and it's not the defining characteristic. It's not small firms. It's firms early on in the demographics of the business life cycle. So it's the young firms that are important, not small.
Yeah, and actually, I appreciate this. So I was in saying small firms. I should have said small entrepreneurial early stage startup companies. Yeah, that's perfect.
Nancy
Johnson, I think it's really, really important to include process innovation in the R&D tax credit because I used to do what you've been doing, go in plants a lot, and the innovative character of American manufacturing at the small manufacturing facility is phenomenal. I mean, I've seen companies completely reinvent themselves. So it's not necessarily whether you're small or large. It's whether you're sort of progressive of mind and flexible. And, you know, I've seen both small and large companies go under because they couldn't grasp the pace of change or the pace of customer change or market change. So I'm much more interested in that. Then the other thing is for a while we used to do development grants. So for a while we got fuel cell translation grants in Connecticut because we got the technology going, but we couldn't ramp it up big enough so it was cheap. And then they cut those out. I think this issue of scale is key, and we lose a lot of the value of our innovation by not assisting companies in ramping up to volume that will affect price. So by the time they get to volume, they're gone. Or they get to volume by manufacturing abroad. So I think a lot of our manufacturing, if you just look at the percent of the economy that manufacturing still produces and the size of the employment base that supports that, that percent of GDP, it's astounding. So I think we just have to understand innovation better and adopt public policies. But nothing could be more important, I think, to job growth than R&D tax credit reform and increase. And I think 20% is really too low. We need to do something dramatic to send that signal that we understand innovation, because that's always been our unique kind of superiority to other economies and other societies. So the issue of R&D and of translation grants, I think, would make a big difference in what the outcome of your studies would be.
So I thank you for your comments. I think that on the policy side, how we can overlay and carry over firms who are here in the United States who might have long-term markets. Your suggestion of ramping up that learning curve would be, for example, getting to above 43% that were cheaper than the old technology produced in the United States. I am not a policymaker. I tend to study the dynamics of the industry itself. And so to make policy recommendations, I really turn to the people here in this room. But it does seem to make sense that these firms in the optoelectronics industry were supported by SBIR funding or grants. But I do want to emphasize just that in the dynamics and the models that I've studied, to me, the real takeaway is that in both the automotive industry and in the optoelectronics industry, these firms, when they move manufacturing overseas, that reinforces the old technology. That would be the big takeaway. And the difference between the optoelectronics industry and the automotive industry is that the optoelectronics industry can only afford one plant, and they cannot separate R&D from manufacturing. And I believe that's because they're small, immature, new technology startups, particularly in a process-based industry, and those are particularly going to be hard hit. Whereas in automotive, you can imagine them producing locally for the local region and actually diversifying their technology portfolios due to regional differences. I personally, as an engineer, do not believe this has to be the dynamic. I don't believe the old technology always has to be the one that is also more economically viable overseas. I think part of that is asking our engineers, can they come up with new technologies that are more economically viable in overseas environments that push forward our economy. So that's in part educating our engineers then on those dynamics.
Yes, here and then here.
Dana Urban. We are in an environment right now where there's huge pressure on discretionary spending to reduce it. And without any sort of healing of our problem with mandatory spending, that will continue to be the problem. Has there been any thought of creating some kind of, this is off the wall, but a government sort of venture capital fund that's eventually self-sustaining so it's outside of political pressures? Does anyone, I just wondered if that's a policy idea that anyone floated.
You want to respond to that?
There was a National Academies report that 15, 17 years ago that recommended that. but I think in actually implementing that, the political pressures on it, I mean, there would be a lot of issues in implementation. I don't know whether it was ever proposed in legislation or not, but there has been discussion since then.
This is a primary tool states use to compete against each other, so there's lots of them out there, and unfortunately, the success of states and the failure would also work against a national policy in that area.
Yeah, if you take a look at Massachusetts Technology Development Corporation, I think it's called, that was funded in 1979 in the Jobs Bill that Carter and the Congress created, and they ended up getting a bunch of money and they invested it, and early stage, high risk startups in Massachusetts, and the fund is completely self-supporting today. It's sort of got one-time infusion. So to your point and to Nancy's point, there are states that do this, and maybe it's worth us in Washington taking a look at that.
Can I add one thing
really
quickly? I just having studied previously DARPA and how it works, and particularly compelled by the fact that they have technologists in DARPA who brought briefly for brief stints outside of their research community to invest those funds and understand where the technology is going broadly. And I think that's a powerful way to approach these problems, is having actually scientists and technologists go and be part of those types of funding organizations.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mike, we're on the science committee, and as an engineer who worked that way to this field, DuPont and carbide, I'm often concerned. I once had a smart boss who said, if you can't define the term you're using, how do you know whether you're doing it? And I see you're using the term economic competitiveness and economic growth quite a bit, and I really don't understand what that means, which is said, because if you look at the stock market, a tech company announces they're laying off 4,000 white-collar workers, their market value goes up. So that might look good for their portfolio of stock, but probably the people who got laid off do not think that's necessarily a good thing. So since everyone's talking about jobs, could you please provide me a definition that our members could explain to their constituents in terms of understanding what you mean by economic growth?
So I would, for
these policies you're advocating, they need to know how that's going to translate to jobs here and how politicians.
Well, I should be careful first to caveat that in terms of policy application, that's definitely not my role. As an academic, these are some things I might consider, but I think that's really the role of people here in the audience and Rob's and other people here in D.C. to figure out.
Could you just explain what you mean by
economic
growth?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's helpful. So for example, in terms of the optoelectronics industry and growth in GDP, so information technology, advances in Moore's Law led to simultaneous advances in software as well as in hardware. And if we look at Dale Jorgensen at Harvard, he spent most of his career trying to account for how that led it to growth in GDP in the United States. So he believes in the 1990s, based on his work, that half of the growth in GDP can be traced back alone to these advances in microprocessors and the corollary advances in software and hardware that had to match those. So I would say growth in GDP. Again, I'm speaking to technology change. Also, Solo talks about technology change leading to more than 80% of economic growth in the United States.
Yeah, Mike, I define it just what we're trying to get here with competitiveness policy or an innovation policy is we want more rapid productivity growth and more rapid introduction of new processes, products, and business models. That's essentially what we want. Whether you can explain that to a voter, that's luckily not my job. I don't have to do that. That's a different question, whether voters can understand that, what that means, and how to get there. But I think ultimately, from a policy perspective, that's what we want to do. We want to raise productivity. Productivity can be raised either through across the board or through shifting in terms of the value-added mix of your industry. And one of the reasons we care about these kinds of industries is they tend to have high value-added per worker. And so you want more of them than you do low value-added per worker industries. I think I have a question right here, and then I'll go in your
direction. John Rumble. There's another way to look at offshoring, and that it creates incredible trade deficits, which gives the government, say in this case China or India, the opportunity to invest in future high technology. Have you looked at how that impacts the change of, change in design trajectory? Because places like China and Singapore and India are beginning to put a lot of government investment into capturing high tech design capabilities.
So I have not in my work looked at China's investment in high tech. I've actually done some studies since DARPA and the US government's investment in high tech. But what I would say is that I can't predict the future in terms of how long until these engineers exist overseas and can produce these new technologies overseas. That does then lead to, if China could, in my model, if they could produce the new technology with yields of 18% on the front end, which in the US we currently have yields of 30.5%. in the front end. So they would need to have much lower yields for that new technology to be able to compete and be cheaper than the old technology. So their capabilities would not need to be as great in order to be able to begin competing in the new technology. What they're lacking right now is actually the knowledge workers who can do that. And what is far off in that particular case, even though the Chinese government has been investing in optoelectronics quite heavily. So for a matter of fact, they have invested heavily in these small mom and pop shops that are supplying the firms that have gone over there. And you see those same investments actually in the other. So my firms don't only move to China, they move to Singapore and Malaysia, Taiwan, and Thailand. But those investments at this point are not leading to the types of knowledge workers who could produce the new technology yet. That doesn't mean that's not there. What they seem to be leading to is lots of small startups, mom and pop shops supplying the main firms. And if I could add one other thing on that point, which would be that I think how long it would take China to develop this technology is only half the question, because we do have the issue of Intel believes it needs to be able to integrate 7 functions on a single chip, and this is just 2 functions. So if we have engineers here in the United States working to continue to push forward that capability, which hasn't happened in these firms, except for the one that's venture-backed and the 2 that have started up, the major force of the industry has gone overseas, then you could imagine us much more quickly getting there than they do.
I think just a quick follow-up. But we do have a model of what happened in Japan, say in the automobile industry, where in the 1950s and 1960s, Japan cars were notoriously bad, and by 1980, they were notoriously good. So we're not talking centuries here, we're talking a decade or so for a country that Besson is engineering workforce to catch up.
Yeah.
So, you know, the time scales are getting compressed.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I think the fastest way so right now we've just had 2 graduates that I've been able to track so far take professorship positions over in China in this particular field, but it's going to take them 4 years to produce, or at least 2 for a master's to produce a graduate. So you might think returnees from the United States might be a faster way for them to try to develop those capabilities.
If we just have time for maybe 2 more if we're quick. Yes, sir, right here.
Yoli Yama of the Mitsuyan Company. As much as the U.S. does offshore, you accept foreign investment, like from Japan, automobile industries are doing fine in this country. Their purpose is a market. The U.S. market is very attractive for the foreign investment to U.S. But in your study, have you checked if the foreign investment contributes to this country's innovation or does it hurting the technology base? And is there any lesson you could learn from accepting foreign investment for your suggestion to the offshore manufacturing?
So I'm gonna take your question and sort of respond slightly differently. What I believe my study shows is that the economics of where technology will develop, if manufacturing is local here in the United States, is going to be different. We're going to get different technologies than manufacturing is overseas. I think there's some industries where they can afford multiple manufacturing sites globally, and there's some that can only afford one manufacturing site globally, and that's going to have different implications for how those industries' technologies then evolve. So if you do have investment in manufacturing for the United States, the technologies that come out of that are going to be different, and I think that's where my study would pretty much end in its comments here.
Time for one more. Yes, sir, back here.
Yeah, Pat White from Peter Duane. Talking about headland here production versus offshore production, I'll refer to it as you're getting process economics at a different scale. It's not just making more of them that get you a cost advantage. Rob mentioned the two DARPA programs, Semitech for the chip industry, which is now an independent organization, still operates, still works, and Meritech, which is the shipbuilding program, which now resides over in the Office of Naval Research as part of the National Shipbuilding Research Program. What both of those two groups did was focus on process technology, not product technology. So I don't think you can put too fine a point on emphasizing not just tax credits, but real cash investment in those cross-cutting manufacturing technologies, which allows multiple products to come to market. You mentioned in passing, but I think that's something that really needs to be emphasized. But when we've done it, it works.
Yeah, and I would actually, if you look at, so to underscore your point, if you look at this industry, they are in a stage right now where they don't have CAD models, they can't get their engineers off the production line. So this is where the semiconductor industry was 30 years ago, and this was Semitech did invest in helping develop computer-aided design capabilities in the industry, helping develop manufacturing process capabilities in the industry, that did at least lead to much, well, there was much change then after that in the U.S.'s capabilities in manufacturing. It's somewhat disputed, the causality, among some academics.
Yeah, but it seems logical if we're going to come up with a whole new suite of products that are better than anybody else is designing,
yes,
the chances of our being able to build it straight out of the blocks is pretty slim.
Absolutely, and for a matter of fact, there is a lot of talk in the industry if we couldn't get a foundry. The industry couldn't get a foundry. The problem is, A, they don't have the computer-aided design capabilities to get the engineers to be able to put the design in a computer program and send it off to the foundry yet, and they don't have sort of the collaboration necessary right now in the industry to create those types of foundries, because you do need some sort of body organization to coordinate within, and those bodies are rather fractured in the industry at this time. Yeah, it's a great point.
Great. I know there's several other questions. I think Erica's going to be here for a few minutes. If you have, you want to ask her or Tom questions individually, please feel free to do that. This was a great presentation, and Tom, very helpful remarks. So please join me in thanking Tom.